From WAMC in Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly magazine about New York State government and politics. Your host is David Gastina, with political commentary by Dr. Alan Shartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength is Not for Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.
Coming up this week, mayors come to Albany for what's known as Tin Cup Day. Our political observer, Alan Shartok, will share his thoughts on one of the mayor's demands, and we'll take a look at how the Hudson River is maintained as an important commercial highway. Those stories and more on the Legislative Gazette. Mayors from around New York testified before the state legislative fiscal committees this week. It's what's traditionally known as Tin Cup Day, where many ask for more money, while others ask for authorization to collect more money from their citizens. The Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt has more.
First up was New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio, who came armed with a new report that he says shows how he could fast-track a pre-kindergarten expansion that he calls one of the largest in the nation's history.
Our city, in partnership with schools, community-based providers, and families, is well-positioned to take this on and at a rapid pace, and we're ready to begin right away.
De Blasio says he's identified 4,000 classrooms that could be ready for 54,000 four-year-olds by September. And he says the remainder of the 73,000 eligible for pre-K could begin by January 2016. Governor Cuomo has recommended phasing in universal pre-K more slowly. He said in his budget address that the state could fully fund pre-K in 5 years. But de Blasio does not want to wait that long. He's not backing down from a plan to raise the city's income taxes on the wealthy to provide a dedicated funding source for pre-K. He told legislators on the joint fiscal committees that he'll continue to ask for their permission to raise the tax because he says the program needs a predictable and consistent funding source.
We're not asking Albany to raise the state income tax by a single penny to pay for universal pre-K and after-school programs in New York City. We're simply asking Albany to allow New York City to tax itself, its wealthiest residents.
Later, de Blasio and Cuomo, who have been longtime allies, downplayed their differences over pre-K funding in an unrelated joint news conference on a federal Medicaid waiver. Cuomo says while he thinks his proposal to phase in pre-K without raising taxes is the best proposal, he's willing to talk with the man he calls his longtime friend.
The question becomes, well, how do you do it? And that's the discussion that we're going to be having over the next several weeks.
Mayor de Blasio agrees that it's natural that he and the governor disagree at times.
Guess what, guys? Once in a while, we may have different perspectives.
Expanding pre-kindergarten is not just the concern of the New York City mayor. Syracuse Mayor Stephanie Miner, who along with other mayors testified at the legislative hearings, says she would also like to offer all-day pre-kindergarten to four-year-olds in her city.
We can't afford not to do universal pre-K. We are losing an entire generation of young people. We have to, as I said, particularly with children who are born into poverty, they need that extra assistance to compete with their wealthier peers.
Upstate cities do not have the ability to increase income taxes. They rely mainly on a dwindling property tax base. As a result, many are strapped for cash, so any pre-K expansion would be dependent on more money from the state. Some, like the cities of Albany and Rochester, are already seeking help from a special financial review board set up by Cuomo. Rochester Mayor Lovely Warren echoed Mayor de Blasio's rhetoric of income equality. She says her city has the worst school district in the state and the fifth highest child poverty rate in the nation.
Rochester is a tale of two cities. One city is vibrant, hopeful, wealthy, and highly livable. The other suffers from escalating unemployment, poverty, dysfunction, and our unemployment in some of our neighborhoods are higher today than they were in the Great Depression.
Mayor Warren says her city has already laid off workers and consolidated services. Now state lawmakers need to start adding funding this year to the Assistance for Municipalities, or AIM aid, to address her city's inequities. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok. Alan, mayors came to Albany this week to talk about what they need in their cities. And of course, all eyes were on Mayor Bill de Blasio, who has called for taxing those making over $500,000 in the city to pay for full day pre-kindergarten. And he stuck to his guns.
That's right, David. The Cuomo people have gone out of their way to have photographs and others of the mayor and the governor together. These are two different wings of the Democratic Party. There is the Cuomo way, which is people are very aware that they're paying a lot of money in taxes, and the pollsters will tell this to Cuomo, and Cuomo will go out and say, okay, we have to stop the amount of money that we are taxing people. And that puts him into the conservative Clintonian camp, and, you know, people have responded very well to it. His popularity is immense. In comes Bill de Blasio into New York City, becomes elected, comes out of the herd of candidates and is elected on a very progressive tale of two cities message. And de Blasio now has the other side of the Democratic Party, the progressive side, which says that you have progressive taxation, you tax the people who have the most in order to help the people who have the least. And to do that, you create a system of pre-K education, which we know will help people immensely in terms of the other end, staying out of jail, having good jobs. We know that the earlier you can educate kids, the better off that they are going to be. And de Blasio insists on pre-K. The governor sees the train coming down the track, obviously, and he says, okay, you can have your pre-K, but we're not going to tax to do it. We're going to find a way to do it. But it won't be taxing the wealthy in New York City, for example, who make over $500,000. Well, along comes the governor, and he says, we'll give you that. And de Blasio says, no, we insist that you tax the very rich. And this puts these two men at absolute odds. The tax-cutting governor of New York, who believes in the sort of centrist position to recruit the purples, those people between the reds and the blues, into the party, and de Blasio, who comes with the banner of equality, tale of two cities, and let's make sure that there's a steady stream of income. Along comes the teachers' union, and what do they say? They say, well, you know, we think that what's happened is that the governor, in order to give de Blasio what he wants, the pre-K, I'm giving a little extra flesh to this. The unions are now saying, well, you know what's happening? They are going to take from the rest of education to do the pre-K, and that education's going to suffer. And they make their case. So that's where we stand right now. Will we have pre-K? Undoubtedly. Who will pay for it? That's the question up in the air.
The president delivered his State of the Union address this week, Alan, and in it included the mention of natural gas. I'm wondering whether or not that has any effect here in New York, as the governor and the rest of the state still await a decision from the health commission.
It is clear that the Cuomo people have decided that they're not going to do fracking for a while. Now, whether they do it in the long run, I don't know. You have a president giving a State of the Union address in which he says, look, we're almost at energy independence, and there's no question that he's a pro-fracker. And now you got Cuomo, who has this tiger by the tail, which is that in New York, fracking has become so contentious that Cuomo clearly, who was for it in the beginning, is not for it right now. So what have they done? They said to the DEC, the Department of Environmental Conservation, go out and study it. They took their time, they came back, and they said, well, you know, the one part of this that really hasn't been heard from is the health part. That's right, because we don't know what's going to happen as a result of this fracking. The health commissioner is told to go out and study it. Well, he's studying it, but he's studying it real slowly. And this takes Cuomo off the hook because he says, we're not doing anything till we hear from the health commissioner. In the meantime, all of those people from Yoko Ono and Natalie Merch and everybody else seem pretty happy about the way in which it is going now.
As you mentioned, fracking and the protests against it, we can't forget this week that the world lost a national icon, Pete Seeger,
who was very much involved in the fight over hydraulic fracturing in New York, and of course other fights like the Hudson River. And Alan, of course, your relationship very close with Pete, and a great loss this week.
Yeah, we did. You know, 94 years old, he had a good life. But believe me, he is a figure in New York that has led the way for many people on the very fights that you were talking about. And when you talk about cleaning up the Hudson River, I was watching Law and Order one night, they said something like there was an environmental question, and one of the detectives said, you know, what is he, another Pete Seeger or something like that? I mean, Pete Seeger is when we think of the environment, when we think of cleaning up the Hudson River, when we think of the PCBs, Pete led the way, but he did a lot more than that. You know, it's very interesting, David, that there are now a couple of moves here to honor Pete. Pete was a man who did not like to get honored. And there was one point at which a lot of people had come together to name the bridge over the Hudson for Pete, and Pete didn't want it at the time. But now Pete's gone, and there are two moves. One is to name the new Tappan Zee Ridge for Pete, and the other is the, you know, walkway over the Hudson for Pete. That ought to be done. In fact, a lot of people think Pete should have had the Nobel Prize because of his efforts on part of world peace. You know, in New York, we tend to name things after politicians. Yeah, you heard the tongue. You know, Hugh Carey gets a bridge or a tunnel named after him. Ed Koch. That's not right. Here's an opportunity to honor Pete, either by taking the new Tappan Zee Bridge and naming it for Pete, or the walkway over the Hudson, so that New Yorkers will remember the immense contributions of this man. Not a bunch of tinhorn politicians, but to honor a man who has given us so much. Do I think it's going to happen? I don't. I don't think that they have, the political class has it in them to do what's right. But maybe I'll be surprised. I've been hearing from people like New York Assembly Health Chairman Dick Gottfried, who desperately wants to do this and who has a bill that will do it. And we'll see. Of course, the Seeger family will have to play a part in this. If they don't want it, it ain't going to get done. If they do want it, I think there's a very good chance that there'll be this mobilization of all the people who honor Pete.
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Shartok. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. The New York Farm Bureau outlined its state priorities and discussed the just-passed federal farm bill this week during a conference call. The Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley was on the line and filed this report.
The group that advocates for farmers across the state indicated that New York Governor Andrew Cuomo has already taken up some of its issues in the executive budget. New York Farm Bureau President Dean Norton says the proposed change in the estate tax could benefit nearly 3,000 farms and help a new generation of farmers. Norton would like to see creation of a program for agriculture similar to Startup New York, granting 10 years of tax exemptions for new farms. He is also discussing with legislators the idea of refundable investment tax credits for farmers.
It's always been a tax credit that's been held in abeyance. A lot of our farming operations have invested greatly over the last decade. There's a lot of credits that are held in their accounts. Let's work at maybe finding a way to make some of them refundable so the dollars can be refunded that can be reinvested back into their farm.
At the same time the New York Farm Bureau was outlining its state priorities, members of the U.S. House took their final vote on the federal farm bill. After 2 years of often stalled negotiations, the nearly $100 billion a year bill passed 251 to 166. The five-year bill now goes to the Senate, which is expected to send it to the president. The final version changed the Dairy Security Act to what Dean Norton calls a base program.
Because of some concerns in the House, we didn't end up with the supply management program that we had asked for. But when it comes to dairy, you know, I think we got about 85% of what we asked for. Farmers, agriculturalists have been waiting for this for a couple of years, and now we'll have some certainty that we can make some plans for our operations for the next 5 years.
Vermont Farm Bureau President Clark Hinsdale notes that while this region tends to follow the dairy provision first, there are other important aspects to the bill.
There's funding in there for projects like farmland preservation, like the Environmental Quality Incentive Program for people to do farming practices that protect water quality, which we're under an increasing amount of pressure to do, and funding for rural development. There's so many things in a farm bill that go beyond traditional concepts of a farm bill. The SNAP program is a part of the farm bill. It's a very important piece of legislation to the country.
Hinsdale is disappointed that the supply management program for dairy farmers was stripped from the bill.
The question is whether or not the substitution provisions will be as effective. And those substitution provisions are that you could only insure up to 90% of your milk production.
Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders issued a statement noting the farm bill is complicated with positives and negatives. He noted one of the bad things about the final version of the bill is the cuts made to nutrition programs. Those cuts within the food stamp or SNAP program, according to Hunger Free Vermont Executive Director Marissa Parisi, total $8.6 billion.
They're very serious, and the cuts are to a program called Heat and Eat, which affect 14 states where heating or cooling costs are very high. Basically, this program, using its connection with IHEAP, allows a state to help people get more SNAP benefits who have high heating costs. So in, you know, New York State, in Vermont, we have very high heating costs, especially right now. This was a great program that now will experience cuts, and we think most of those 14 states will no longer be able to operate the program.
Governor Cuomo's office released data Wednesday showing that New York State is now the third largest producer of milk in the nation.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
Some residents, politicians, and community advocates recently voiced their concerns about plans to build a crude oil heating facility at the Port of Albany. State Department of Environmental Conservation appears to have been listening. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas explains.
Residents of the Ezra Prentice Homes and others in the South End neighborhood gathered late last week at a public information meeting concerning construction of a new 2,600-square-foot crude oil heating facility at the port's rail yard. Global Partners of Massachusetts wants to build a plant to heat crude as it is pumped from tanker cars into storage tanks. The Department of Environmental Conservation had been taking public comments through January 31st, but the deadline has been moved. The new deadline is April 2nd. First Ward Councilwoman Dorcia Pleer says the local community worries that the new building may mean increased air pollution, adding to dangers already posed by the tankers. She regards the extended DEC deadline as a true testament to what can happen when the community speaks out.
I believe that the press conference, in addition to all of the letters, emails, and then also the media coverage, I think all of those things combined contributed to the DEC deciding to extend the comment period.
Appleers would like to obtain more information regarding how the facility would impact public health. The DEC responded to a request for comment by email claiming the safety of all New Yorkers is of the highest priority. It has scheduled a new public information meeting February 12th at the Giffen Memorial Elementary School in Albany. The DEC says, quote, this meeting will provide an overview of the permit and its impact. And that permit entails modifying Global's air permit to include heated petroleum products such as crude oil and biofuels. Back in July, longtime rail safety advocate U.S. Senator Charles Schumer was in downtown Albany to express his concern for New Yorkers who live and work in communities along freight rail lines traveled by oil-bearing tankers.
Safety experts in transportation will tell you that the DOT 111 car is flawed. They're prone to tears and spills in the event of derailments.
Schumer has called on the Federal Railway Administration and the Department of Transportation to require railroads to stop using or retrofit the standard DOT 111 tank car. Tankers regularly park on the rails, running behind South End residences and playgrounds. In a related matter, the chair of the City of Albany Conservative Committee says the port needs an oil refinery of its own. Joe Sullivan claims it would expand the City of Albany property tax base.
Create good-paying jobs and lower the cost of gasoline and heating oil locally, both of which are above the national average. Result of all this would be economic expansion and property tax relief in the city of Albany.
While no mention was made of exactly where such a refinery could be built, Dorsey Appleer says she would need details and much more information before weighing in on further port expansion. Neighbors are planning to hold get-togethers to stay abreast of developments as they occur.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. The Hudson River is no longer the commercial highway it once was, but it's still an important route for the state's economy. To keep the river open for business in the freezing winter months, the Coast Guard runs its cutter boats up and down the river, opening a navigable track through the ice. The Innovation Trail's Jenna Flanagan joined one of the Coast Guard vessels to see how it's done.
It's freezing cold on the bridge of the Penobscot Bay. 17 crew members carefully guide the 140-foot ship through a river that looks more like a gorge lined with thick chunks of white rock rather than ice.
We've seen some what we consider moderate ice conditions, which is 8 inches or greater. It can stop some of these tug and barges from navigating, and a Coast Guard cutter or another tug will have to come and assist and break a path so they can either get through or get to the dock they're going to.
That's basically their job, making sure commerce ships can safely navigate the river during the winter months. Lieutenant Commander James McCormick is in charge of this cutter. He says all types of businesses still use the river for transport.
We've talked to guys shipping grain, GE generators, it's kind of a variety of goods. The tug and barges, for the most part, my understanding is petroleum products. So home heating oil, gasoline.
For the Coast Guard, icebreaking season begins December 16th and lasts until the spring thaw. What sets this icebreaking tug apart is its bubbler system, a white Connex box on the rear of the ship that houses a low-pressure air compressor. It pushes air down through the hull into openings along the keel, which help push the boat through the thick ice.
The last design feature we have is the bow is flared out so that when we hit significant ice, we'll actually ride up onto the ice and the weight of the cutter will come down and break it.
Despite a half a foot of ice along the center of the river, the cutter seamlessly tacks along at 10 knots until the river traffic picks up.
Hey, Chief, I think I'm going to have you just come up here and come to the right, turn the bubbler off, and just bring her back to 60. Just let him go by.
Thank you.
A barge is headed down the river through the track the Coast Guard has been maintaining. McCormick has his crew steer aside into something called fast ice. Lieutenant Zach Ballard explains the move.
We like to maintain a groomed track in these areas of thicker ice. So they were headed south in that groomed and open track, and we just kind of pulled over to the side into some fast ice that's frozen solid near the shore.
Once the barge passes, we pull back into the main river track. Fast ice, or non-moving ice, drifting ice, and plate ice are all part of the Hudson River winter geography that Commander McCormick's crew must navigate.
Pressure ridges is basically what happens when you have two plates that push up against each other. The ice has nowhere to go but up, and it'll pile up on top of each other, and that pressure is actually tougher for ships to get through, and you can get a foot or two of ice.
McCormick says it's crucial for commerce ships to stay on the river track when traveling the Hudson in winter. He says trying to forge your own path will dislodge too much ice and allow more of the river to freeze overnight, forcing his crew to start from scratch in the morning. The Coast Guard will send icebreakers as far north as Albany to keep the river open all season. From West Point on the Hudson, I'm Jenna Flanagan for the Innovation Trail.
And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. Copies are available. Call 1-800-323-9262. That's 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 1405. Or just listen to podcast on the web at wamc.org. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.
Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength is Not for Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.